Hello, this is a podcast from SCC English, the English department of St. Columba's College, Dublin in Ireland. Visit our blog at sccenglish.ie.
Hello, this is Julian Gerdam from SCC English. Welcome to our ninth podcast. The following recording is an interview with and reading by the poet Louise C. Callaghan. It was carried out in March 2009 and now is being broadcast in May 2009. Visit our blog sccenglish.ie for more.
So, first of all, Louise, many congratulations, because we've just heard recently that you have been shortlisted for a major poetry prize. So could you tell us about that?
Yes, the Strokestown Poetry Prize, International Poetry Prize. I was very surprised and delighted to be to see my name on the list of contenders, and it means that we'll all be invited to Strokestown during the literary festival in May, first week in May, to read our work, not only the winning poem but the rest, you know, a couple of other poems. So do you want me to talk about that poem?
Yes, and please, yeah, and indeed to read it for us. So each poet is shortlisted because of a single poem. That's right, isn't it?
That's right. Yeah. That's right. It's called the Single Poem Poetry Prize. Yes.
So could you tell us about your poem's title, and then, of course, you're going to read it.
It's called The Binder's Notes, and it's a poem that I wrote when I was living in St. Andrews in Scotland. I was doing an MLit there, and one of our courses was, it was in creative writing, the MLit, and specialising in poetry, which is what I was doing, and we had a course called research and how to use research, both internet research and library research, in our poetry. And this very second class in that series, it was held in the library in one of their archive rooms. And for the second one, I had to go home suddenly and I missed it. And one of my fellow students, Paulo from Brazil, told me about it, and he said, if you like, I'll take you down to the special holdings and show you the manuscripts in the library holdings, which we talked about and we were told about in last week's class. And so anyway, this poem grew out of a manuscript which the librarian took out for me and laid out on the table, and it was a medieval manuscript which St. Andrews had in its holding, and it really inspired the poem, I suppose. And there was a little letter at the back of this amazing manuscript. There was a letter, a kind of a three-page letter to the librarian about, from the binder, with his headed note paper called D&C Binders and Son, something like that. And that's where this poem was found. The binder's notes. It was heavy, difficult to hold, and as slippery as that salmon my son caught last season. I lifted it like a baby from its cradle, from trolley to table, the cockled, creased leaves spilling over like an accordion, the pages open mid-conversation between Og, St. Augustine, and Adeo, in Latin, of course. The M of Memorit seems lit within. On my report form, I note its condition. Oak boards, damaged both front and back. Binding leather, broken. Of five bosses, one is preserved. I note the gnawed edges of vellum, a medieval rat, and spills of candle wax. But the irreparable vandalism of a guide letter, crudely excised, is a gaping silence which pains me. Like a child's body, a child of mine, defiled. I can only imagine gold leaf motifs of entwined animals whose tails turn inexplicably into serpents, or vine stems half hiding dismayed birds. If I could effect a repair, I would, willingly, and gather it up with unexpected care.
That's a lovely poem. I only saw it about an hour ago for the first time. One thing that our listeners won't realize is what it looks like on the page, which is very spare. I mean, there are two or three words sometimes per line, and it moves very sinuously. It's like those serpents, I think. Your style is very often, not always, but it's often very, very pared down and spare as it is there. The line is quite short. Is that something you're conscious of, or do you... It just comes naturally.
In some ways, it's much easier to control a poem with a short line. And often I have ambitions to write a long line, a much longer line. I don't know why. It's easier to write a short line. Especially if you don't have a strict form, you know, if you're not trying to write a sonnet or... But, yeah, I think my poems seem to be divided between poems that are very short lines and those that are much chunkier. And, in fact, I have another poem, which this poem reminds me of, insofar as this poem is not in my own voice. You know, it's in the binder's voice. And I have another poem, which is one of the very first poems I ever wrote. And it's in my first collection called The Puzzle Heart, and it's called The Palatine Daughter Marries a Catholic. And that also came to me out of research. I was doing some research about something completely different in the National Library in Kildare Street. And I came across this, again, a letter, an extraordinary letter in their holding from Queen Anne to the Duke of Marlborough about the poor Palatines who were being persecuted in Alsace-Lorraine or something like that in the middle of the 1700s, or no, the very, very beginning of the 1700s, the sort of religious wars. And anyway, I quite like to read that poem, but it's also not in my voice. The I is the Palatine daughter, who is this Protestant girl. There was a song written about her in Irish, Inian na Falatini. It's been made into a song.
I'd love to hear it in a second. Can we just explain, can you explain who the Palatines were? Because it's an extraordinary and kind of forgotten episode of our Irish psyche, really.
Yes, that's a nice idea that it is part of our culture and part of our psyche. The Palatines were a sect of Moravian Protestants from the Palatinate, which was an area. I don't think it exists anymore. In Rhineland,
yes,
Germany.
They call it the Pfalz now. I've been there. In fact, it's a beautiful part of the world. The wine road goes right through it.
And they were being persecuted by the French during the religious wars in the 16th, 17th century. And Queen Anne from England referred to them in her correspondence to the Duke of Marlborough as the poor Palatine. I loved that. And she asked him to go on to their rescue, and I think a number of boats went, and they were brought first of all back to Liverpool, and then some of them were brought further on to Ireland, and they settled in places like Limerick and Waterford, and eventually they sort of integrated into the Catholic community, because originally they were brought to kind of bolster up the Cromwellian planter settlers, and they were given land from the dispossessed. But ironically, eventually they married in more to the Catholic and integrated more into the Catholic cultures and Catholic communities in their towns and villages.
So let's so go ahead with Bohm. Yes, that explains
position
it.
Position it somewhat. Yeah. The Palatine daughter marries a Catholic. I am a stranger in your country. It is my hair, unlike anyone else's. You say it is the wrong kind of water to wash brass-coloured hair. Use rainwater, I suppose. I was taken from my Rhine-watered land, washed up on someone else's tide, a pale corpse, cordially hated by the natives. You said I was a lily, that my skin reminded you of beeswax. Now I have not the least sense of place, never wear the same colour twice, work wherever I find myself, read as if I don't exist, make the land ripen, the timeless hillside of firs of apple blossom, the compost dark and smellless by constant turning, till I'm summoned by marriage like a piece of furniture to the nearby barony, the other side of Sea Finn. Our Bibles are all buried now. My back is against the light of Glen O'Sheen. I have not given birth in this land. And when you say you love me, I wonder what it is you think you love. The land of no return, the river of the morning star, the warm walled kitchen garden, the flax patches of blue haze, or is it the grey canvas shoes beneath my strange palatine bed? Yes, I will let you come to me. I'm all yours. Only don't expect me to talk of love, even in my sleep, nor honour your people's oppositions, when here is no safe haven for settler or dispossessed.
Now, looking at that on the page, just what we're talking about, you have lots long lines. Maybe it's easier in that kind of liberated other voice to write that longer line, taking on a voice rather than your own, in a sense. I know we're going to talk a little while about your own, you know, mining your own memory and childhood and so on. But there's one more poem, which from this side of your poetry, the idea of research and the idea of putting together poems which are, as I say, not mined directly out of your own childhood, which is what we're going to come to next, poems of memory. And this poem that you're going to read in a moment is called Fragments. Mm-hmm. So where does that come from?
A lot of poems, thinking about those three poems, a lot of poems come from the shock of the new or the surprise of the new. Going somewhere I've never been before, somewhere that really thrills me or resonates in some way, as will be the case with this Fragments poem, or reading something, as in the case of the Palatines, reading something so incredibly interesting and exciting that I've never known before, really sort of can inspire you. Just the strangeness of something you never knew before. And the same with the binder's notes. It was the details of the process and the different terms, the terminology of the process, and the strangeness of this extraordinary handmade manuscript from 600 years ago. So anyway, that's just by way of an introduction to Fragments. Fragments I wrote after I was invited to give a workshop in the island of Lesbos, which was Sappho's island. Sappho, the almost prehistoric poet, pre-Christian poet, who came from that island. And I was in the northwest of the island, where she was supposed to have had her school of poets, a little bit like the bardic poets in Ireland and in Celtic culture. So anyway, a lot of Sappho's poems were destroyed. Well, a lot of them weren't written down, but those that were written down were destroyed. They found them wrapping mummified bodies. It reminds me of the Dead Sea Scrolls or something like that. But the mind boggles, really. So that accounts for why this poem is called Fragments. Fragments. Sung at weddings, then sung again at birthday festivities. Recited by Clyth, her daughter, under the almond tree. Memorized, copied out, countless times translated. Aeolian songs on papyrus. For years, they were torn into strips to wrap dead bodies. Read by us late last night at your kitchen table. In winter sunshine, we scoured the hills behind your house for rock mementos. Sappho of Lesbos, of Scala Arezzos, walked these hills with her scholar girls. Feathered shoots of dill, the same sea. What troubled her now troubles me.
Of course, it's called Fragments, but it ends up not a fragment itself, and that was the case with the first poem, The Binder's Notes. It's a poem about something which is from the past, but actually brought to life again in your own words, kind of coherently, as it were. So we'll now move on to a poem of memory and childhood. So would you like to tell us about the next one, please?
Yes, the next poem is called, with this terribly difficult title, called Traders Magneto Dynamo Company, otherwise known as TMDC. It was the name of my father's business. He manufactured car parts and also distributed car parts to motor mechanics. And he started life as a motor mechanic. And he had the misfortune to have five daughters, so the business went with him. He never intended or never considered training any of us in to take over from him. But I could never remember the name Traders Magneto Dynamo Company. And, you know, when I was seven or eight, somebody asked me once, you know, what my father worked at. And I really wanted to remember the name, but I couldn't. So that's why I've called this poem Traders Magneto Dynamo Company, because I'll remember it forever now, the name of his business. So that's a very long-winded introduction. It'll also possibly be the name of my next collection, which I'm working on at the moment, which has a lot of memory poems in it. And another introduction to this poem, I have here a little epithet, which could probably go for the next three poems, which are all poems prompted by childhood memory. And it's this German poet, a line I lifted out of his poem. It goes like this: sometimes my childhood sends me a postcard. So these are like three postcards from my childhood. So shall I start and read?
Yes, please do. Yeah.
Traders Magneto Dynamo Company.
That's right. And in a little while, we'll talk as well about the new collection and how close you're getting to it. But let's hear these poems.
All right. TMDC started our Father's Day in much the same way as AMDG headed ours. Four pencil-formed letters in the left-hand margin, at the top of our school copies. The day and date opposite it. Everything that we wrote was devoted to God. Father aspired to the motor car and to the manufacture of small car parts. But first he drove us to school in his lovely old 50s Rover with its wide running boards. The bell that brought order to our lives ringing out as I climbed from the back seat.
I should point out as well that the title of your previous collection, Remember the Birds, features a sequence, that sequence, about your father as well. A lovely series of memories in that sequence.
Yes. I might read, if I read maybe just one of those, the first
sure,
one.
Sure, do, yes. Do you want to do that now?
The title poem. Yes, why not?
And just while Louise is finding that poem, reminder, you're listening to SCC English podcast. You can visit our blog at sccenglish.ie. I'm Julian Gurdon. I'm talking to Louise Callaghan, who is now going to read a poem from her most recent collection, Remember the Bird. So, Louise, off you go there.
This is the title of the book called Remember the Birds, and it's the title poem, the first poem in a series. And it's about a little tray that my father made at school. He left school at about 16, and the best that can be said for his education was that he did a little bit of woodwork and he was quite clever with his hands. He was also a very inventive person. And this opening poem is called The Little Tray. In my hall, the walnut console holds father's woodcrafted tray, the flute lip tidy for assorted keys, letters, household bills, and my bottle of rescue. That he made it himself never struck me so much as the motto, the words he'd chosen to groove into the surface, Remember the Birds, as if there were nothing more meaningful he could think of. His deadpan sense of the absurd, Remember the Birds. No philosophy, no moral. I let my lofty expectations go, and I use the little tray for crumbs to scatter and to carry them.
And would you like to move on then to the other two memory poems?
Yes. The next poem is like a follow-on from The Trader's Magneto, insofar as it's me as a probably 6-7 year old. I was mildly dyslexic. I didn't learn to read really till I was 8. And this poem is called The Trick Is. Leaning over my first reader, eyes glued to my index finger, I try to configure a river out of those difficult alphabet words. At the exit bell for break, I'm summoned to return my book to the shallow drawer of the cabinet. But the trick is not to let anyone see the wet stain on the back of my school skirt. I remain on in the squat little chair, but really I disappear.
Thank you. And you're going to move on.
That's more like a magic trick.
It is, yes. Yeah.
Than getting the hang of reading or anything else.
That's right, yes. And your next one
is another
recent poem.
Yes, yes, and it's really prompted by what is one of my earliest memories. And the poem is called 2½. And it's about... My mother used to lead me sometimes into this woman who lived with her family in the back of Fitzwilliam Square to be minded. This woman, Lally is her name, she used to look after my older sisters when they were born. She came with my mother to my mother's house after her first two children were born, and she wasn't exactly their wet nurse, but she was their nursemaid, until she got married herself and left. So this is called 2½. Once more I lifted the crimson cloth to peep into the dark space under the table, to see the baby crawling there, her bare bottom, the stockingless legs and broken down shoes. Then next door in the big empty room, shoving before me a red tin hen. With sharp clackety-clack wings and whining wheels, I scutter up and down over splintered boards. I've found the baby's bed, the pull-out nest, in the drawer of their bedroom chest. But this is 1950, off Fitzwilliam Square, lamplit rooms over the coach house stable. If you peered in the window under the roof, you'd have seen Lally at the table, her sister May, Jimmy, and the old father with the hook screwed into the end of his wooden arm.
You mentioned that you are moving towards a new book. You've been reading from several new poems on sheets here in front of me. So how long do you think before you have that collected? How long do you think it'll be before we see your third book?
It's about 5 years since my last book came out, I think. And really I have the bones of more than one collection of poems. The question will be what goes into what and what stays out. My publishers are not ready. I'm in a queue.
Right. And yeah, this is Salmon.
So it'll be, yes, that's right, yeah. Salmon Poetry. Yeah. And I suppose it's the queue. I'll reach the top of the queue about this time next year.
Right.
Okay. 2010.
Looking forward to that.
Yeah.
But we've had a preview. So now I'd like just in the last few minutes to move on to the reason why you're in St. Columbus at the moment, and you've been visiting us for a few years now, which is to do creative writing classes, especially with our junior pupils, and prompting them towards their own poetry. We have quite a poetry culture here. We've got poetry prizes coming up next week, and we publish a lot of poetry in our blog. In the last couple of days, you've been with our primary pupils, so the youngest pupils in the school. I'd just like you to say a little bit about how you organize these kind of workshops, these workshops with younger pupils. We're talking kind of 12, 13, 14-year-olds, basically, that you worked with in St. Columbus over the last couple of years. So how do you start off that process for them? You're obviously only seeing them a brief amount of time, unlike their teacher, who has them for the whole year. So how do you kick-start that kind of workshop?
You're very open to poetry here in a quite remarkable way. You know, often in schools, poetry is welcomed as something out of the stream of norm, and self-expression isn't so encouraged. Though, even having said that, there is a lot of reservations you have to get over to put yourself on the line, to write a poem. And there's a certain amount of self-censorship that goes on, like, oh, I could never write a poem, or I couldn't do this, or I'm no good at this. And so one way of bypassing that kind of self-censorship is timed writing, where you put the, you know, prepare the student to write on a particular word or set of words or title, and then say, well, now you have 4 minutes.
Yes, force them.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
I say that to them sometimes. I have ways and means of making you talk. And they can find themselves wonderfully surprised at what then comes out of that few minutes, out of their subconscious, really. Because I think the unconscious is the real fertile ground of a poem, of poetry.
I know you say it's particularly important to you to try to help them access that unconscious or subconscious.
Yeah.
And you mentioned timed writing. Are there any other strategies which you think can help them do that?
Sometimes just like a scattering of words.
That they put together themselves. You give them a few seeds, as it were.
Yes, right? Yeah, that's right. I know myself, sometimes I can just think of a word, like, for instance, in that poem, Remember the Birds, that I wrote. It came from a word I saw in a shop window, console. And it was a furniture shop, and there was a narrow table, and on it was written something like console, €200.
Right.
And I thought, oh yeah, that's a lovely word, console. It's got con with in Spanish and soul in it, with soul. Mm. And I thought, oh, I want to write a poem that has that word.
Right.
So anyhow, to get back to writing poems, the younger they are, the more, if you have a kind of a gamey approach, make a game out of it. It helps, you know, so that it's fun what they're doing.
Yes, yeah.
Playing with words.
Yes. I know you're big on them as well, having notebooks, having something to stick in your pocket, and you're sitting in the on the Lewis or wherever, and you know, to pick up a, to use your own word, fragment, then that you can put together eventually.
I think that's for somebody who is ambitious, and I always find among the students here, 4, 5, 6 young people who are, I can see it in them. They're ambitious. They want to write a poem. They want to write a few poems, possibly even want to be a writer. And it is the first tool I would suggest is that they have a notebook with them that they can put in their inside pocket and just keep a list of words.
Yes. Ideas and phrases,
things they overhear. Sometimes things you mishear also is very fertile.
Yes, yeah. Well, your example of console then is a quite a sort of ordinary word in the sense that suddenly struck you and you picked up. Well, Louise, I think we've probably come to the end of our podcast or interview. I'd like to thank you very much. Well, A, for visiting St. Columba's again, but B, for agreeing to be grilled here for our third podcast, and we look forward to your next collection sometime next year perhaps, and the very best of luck at Strokestown, which I think is the beginning of May, isn't it?
That's right. So, well, listen, thank you very much, Julian. It's been a pleasure and lovely to come to this place which is so friendly to poetry.
Thank you very much, Louise.